Welcome to the School of Wellbeing. I'm your host, Meg Durham, wellbeing speaker and teacher wellbeing specialist. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and waters on which this podcast is being recorded. Hello and welcome to episode 117. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you are a big-hearted human that works in schools. And if I had to put money on it, I would bet that you are a hard-working and reliable member of staff with the ability to get things done and make stuff happen. And this is remarkable. Schools function because we make things happen. We have the ability to make the impossible possible, day in and day out. The challenge is, if this ability to dig deep and work hard goes unchecked, it is a recipe for burnout. In today's episode, I have the joy of chatting with Melinda Phillips about the relentless demands of school life and practical ways to release the pressure and invite more joy and connection back into our working lives. Melinda is a psychologist and a teacher with over 20 years of experience working in schools. She has established Compassionate Schools to support teachers and school leaders to be well. Services include individual coaching and counselling for teachers and school leaders, staff professional learning workshops, and consultation around staff wellbeing initiatives. Melinda's research focused on schools and workplace wellbeing, specifically burnout, compassion fatigue, and secondary traumatic stress following critical incidents, and the protective factors that lead to resilience and wellbeing. Melinda is currently an organisational psychology registrar with her focus on schools as workplaces. In this conversation, we discuss how relentlessly high standards can hold us back, why good enough is good enough, the most common ways for teachers to manage their stress, and so much more. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Melinda Phillips. Welcome to the School of Wellbeing podcast.
Thank you for having me, Meg.
Today we're going to be talking about the additional pressures we can put on ourselves as big-hearted and very capable educators. What do you hope teachers and school leaders will gain from listening to this conversation?
Well, I guess we know that local studies of burnout drawn from research conducted here in Australia by Professor Gordon Parker have found that burnout is overrepresented in dutiful, reliable, caring people like teachers and other health professionals. And that's the capable that you've mentioned. But in addition, we also know that the empathy that we can feel for our students and sometimes for their families or our colleagues as well can at times tip into empathic distress, and that can wear us out too. And that's the big-hearted part. So I guess what I'm hoping from this conversation is that people listening in can recognize some things in themselves or perhaps others and take note of those and do with that new knowledge what they will, but to just hear a little bit about those patterns and those temperaments that we often see.
As an educator yourself and someone who has worked with countless educators in so many different settings, what are some of the characteristics of educators that you work with?
Well, when I do whole school work, of course, I get everyone, which is fantastic and love that. So love everyone from the diligent people down the front to the snoozing people up the back. But when I'm working one-on-one with people, I guess there are some different groups of people that I see. So often in terms of role, we have the principals and the school leaders, but also teachers, student support officers or education support workers. We've got business managers. We've got everyone that's within a school. And in terms of, I guess, their well-being, there's people that are being preventative and want to get in front of some stress that they're feeling and put some things in place, and some people that want coaching or supervision or debriefing after a particular event, right through to people who are carrying a lot of stress and a lot of exhaustion. And so I guess the well-being continuum that I see is everybody. And I guess the other thing probably is personal characteristics. And I do see a lot of reliable, conscientious people, a lot of high-achieving people who really want to get things done and do it right. And these can often be school leaders who feel really responsible for both their students and their staff. And And often the impossibility of the workload is what brings these people to seek some support and understand what's going on for them. I love the name of one journal article. I think it was Burnout in Teachers, Shattered Dreams of Impeccable Professional Performance. And that was in the year 2000. So that's a long time ago now. And I was only just teaching then. So I think it means that there's been this long-standing experience of conscientious, high-achieving, well-meaning educators going into teaching, but then discovering that perhaps school is a different creature to the one they imagined or the one they'd hoped for.
That really resonates with me, Mel, the idea of being super conscientious, wanting to be thorough, wanting to do a really, really good job. And the teachers that I work with, this is what I see. This is what I was like. Such hardworking, so diligent, so capable. And I can guarantee the teacher listening to this podcast right now is one of those people, because there's this yearning for more. There's a yearning for growth. There's this feeling of, I can do it. I can make it work. If I just work harder, I can make it work. So why do we put so much pressure on ourselves?
Well, I think it's a little bit like that metaphor or analogy of the frog in the boiling water, although that's obviously a terrible metaphor to use. But it's that sense of, if the water temperature rises slowly enough, we don't really notice what's going on for us. And we just keep trying to keep on and keep up with what we've always done. And I think we know, for example, from the Gallup report in 2021, but many other reports and commission findings over the years, that particularly that one and the principal well-being surveys, that there have been actually profound changes in the volume and complexity of the work that we do as teachers. And that leads to unsustainable workloads, which comes at the detriment of our work, but also of our well-being. But because we're these reliable, conscientious, purpose-driven people, we try to keep on keeping on, regardless of these profound changes that mean, in some ways, you know, school has become an apple that's turned into an orange. But we keep going. And sometimes I think it's these very character traits that we need to take a good hard look at and not overplay these beautiful strengths in our school part of our lives.
Yes, it is so clear now when you say it like that, that we can start to feel that it's personal. I should be able to be on top of this. I should be able to make this situation work. Years ago, I used to be able to make this situation work. And a common sentiment that I hear time and time again is, gosh, it feels like the longer I'm in the job, the harder it's becoming. I thought it would be getting easier, but I feel like it's actually getting harder.
Absolutely. And I think the emotional demands of students and families on us as teachers has changed too. And those emotional needs have really risen. And so I also see people who are sometimes new teachers who are finding their feet of all ages, including career changes, and just finding out the best way to care for the students in their care without costing too much of their own well-being. But also those teachers at every level, from the principal down, in schools where they might be in more of a challenging environment with really high demands and really high needs in their community. And then that cost of caring in this new way that teachers are doing at every single level can ask of us something in those emotional demands that can wear all of us out, no matter how much experience we have. So I think too, if you combine that conscientiousness with that real desire to care for others, which is why so many of us became teachers, that is becoming a bit of a perfect storm that teachers are just trying to face. And their shield is their personality traits and their goodwill, rather than anything else more intentional or more specific or more skill-based.
Yes, the perfect storm is really colliding, bringing our strengths to the fore, but then the demands are increasing. And then it becomes so personal, feeling like I just can't make this work. And then we want to just leave. We want to run. And my hope from having this podcast is that teachers don't leave and run, that they have the opportunity to see, what is the lesson here? What can I learn about myself? Are there times where the reality is it's just not a workable situation? It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me. It doesn't mean that I'm incapable. It just means this is an unworkable situation and I need to be clear and articulate around that. Because something that I see in schools is I'll have leaders talk to me saying that the teachers are really happy. We haven't really had any negative feedback around XYZ. And then you go into the staff room like, oh gosh, the report timetable, the report schedule is ridiculous. No one's really asked us about about it. And then I get curious, are we having the conversations that we need to be having in schools? Or are we stopping ourselves from having those conversations because we're scared that we might be perceived as not capable?
Absolutely. And I think that we need to shift our understanding of what a capable teacher looks like in 2023, 2024, because capacity used to be measured by something very different to what's required of us now. And part of what's required of us now is flexibility and adaptability, but also the capacity to be intentional about calling what's enough and be intentional about calling out when things are too much and asking what we can take off our plate and bringing those skills of managing our workload into school life, not as a deficit model, but as part and parcel of the way that we're working in a situation that, as you've said, isn't really sustainable right now. So it's a new skill set of identifying the work, prioritizing the work, communicating about those priorities and getting agreement, and being okay at every level to hear about when enough's being reached and what we need to do about that.
Mel, I love that you're highlighting it's a new skill set to be able to ask for help. It's a new skill set to be able to articulate to other people in your team how you're going. Or when you're having a conversation around a new change project or a new initiative, to be able to pause and say, well, we're working on 10 other initiatives. Which one are we going to park for now instead of just having more, more and more? And it makes me think about this incredible head of department that I was working with once. And she said this beautiful line, which I share all the time, because it just highlights us in education, is, I have finally worked it out, Meg. People can't catch me if they don't know I'm falling, because she was so frustrated that people weren't helping out and being proactive. And yet, over time, she realized they didn't know. I looked so proficient. I looked so on top of it that they didn't know. And having that skill of articulation, then the team like, oh, I'm happy to help out. I can chip in. But we cannot be caught if people don't know we're falling.
Absolutely. And I think that gets tied into those standards that we briefly mentioned before, that sometimes when we hold very high standards for ourselves, we can tie that into our sense of who we are as well. So we kind of, you know, jump the fence into this is what I do, into this is who I am. And when we pride ourselves on being that high achiever and that capable, competent person who doesn't require help, often is happy to give help, but no, I don't need help, me, that we can do ourselves a disservice because we aren't developing that ability, as you say, to ask for help, but we're also not developing the abilities that we need in this instance now in schools to stay flexible and adaptable and also to know what is enough and what's good enough. I think that school life and being a teacher is never ending. And we all know that because there's no such thing as a perfect lesson and there's no such thing as perfect preparation. There's always more we can do, but we need to learn what's enough. And we also need to learn when we're juggling multiple priorities, what shall I put first and what shall I put second and what shall I put third, and how do I share this with other people so they know what I've prioritized when there is just too much on.
Yes, coming to that question of what is enough? Because by default, we're always looking to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And the skill here is, what is enough? And maybe what I'm doing, I'm creating more work for myself in an already intense environment. Maybe we don't need to have the extra bells and whistles on this certain assignment. Can we just keep to the basics?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to now be the mother and aunt of early career teachers. And so I get to see this firsthand in terms of beautiful preparation, exquisite preparation. And we all have to find our own level. And that's fantastic too. But that sense of enough is really important for us because all our language at school is not around enough. It's around growth. It's around excellence. It's around goals and outcomes. And it's a different paradigm to instead sit in a space of what is enough, as you say, and what does this look like for me, and how can I be satisfied at the end of my workday that what I've done today is enough and does meet needs, and I'm happy with that.
And it's a real shift in thinking because it allows ourselves some time and some respite and some recovery from the day that was, instead of our natural response to finish the day that was tell ourselves, oh, I've got nothing done today, even though we have done 1,000 things, but for whatever reason, we tell ourselves a story that I got nothing done today, maybe because it wasn't off the list. And then we go into the evening thinking, oh, I've just got to do more. I've just got to do more. And what would it be like for us moving into this new year around, that's enough, that will do. And a beautiful teacher that I've worked with, she said she has this rule that by 8 o'clock, whatever hasn't been done will not get done. That's in her personal and professional life. So if the dishes aren't done by 8, it's not done by 8. Like, that's it. That's my sign-off time.
Yeah, fantastic. That's just wonderful. And I know a school leader who has a list of the things that she's not getting to. And that's the list, the things I'm not getting to. And it's such a paradigm shift to go, here's the list, because it acknowledges the impossibility of the workload for school leaders at the moment. And it owns our role in that, in saying, if I'm working already 50 or 55 or 60 hours a week as a school leader, that's enough. And as a consequence, here are the things that I've not got to yet. And I think that's a really great way to start repositioning ourselves. Instead of being responsible for everything, being responsible for the things we can do, and being responsible for articulating the things we're not getting to, so we're not ignoring them or sweeping them under the mat, we're naming them. And if someone wants to help us reprioritize, we're open to that. We're also open to the fact that sometimes it's just not possible to get to everything.
And creating that distance from that identity of I get everything done. Ask a busy person, I'll get everything done. And soothing and settling and softening into I will get done what I have the capacity to get done. And there'll be some other things that I won't get done. And that may be uncomfortable at times. It may be uncomfortable to look at ourselves and see that we haven't got everything done and we're not a superhuman.
I think so. But I think as part of that conversation, it's a really clear-headed look at what's this costing me. So in terms of running at that pace and trying to touch everything and get everything done, what are the costs that I'm wearing? Versus if I dial that back 5% or even 10%, will I get pretty much the same outcomes for the people I teach, the people I care for, the people I lead, but there's a little bit more of me left at the end of the day. So I think there's a real invitation there to spend some time considering, does this benefit me as much as I'm thinking to hold these very high standards and be this conscientious, or are there some tweaks I can make there to lower that pressure a little bit and hold myself accountable for sure, but a less, I guess, perfectionistic 100% excellence kind of framework, and one that invites some more life and space and easing.
Life and space and ease, that sounds very enticing for so many of us. So when we're thinking about the costs, what can be some of the costs of holding on to these rigid, relentless standards?
Well, I think that in part, if we have a look at the classic symptoms of burnout that we might consider when we're looking at burnout, and burnout hasn't yet been given a clinical designation. So you won't go to a GP or a psychologist like me and get a diagnosis of burnout. But what has happened is that the World Health Organization has recognized it as an occupational syndrome. And so the wheels are moving in the right direction. And we also absolutely know it has impacts on our mental health. But if we go back to having a look at what sometimes those really high standards can contribute to, the symptoms of burnout can include first and at its heart, exhaustion. So it's a really big sense of debilitating exhaustion, emotional exhaustion. And then we can also feel more distant from our work. We can feel more cynical about our work, and we can feel that our personal performance is suffering. Now, we don't bring burnout on ourselves because we are high performers and high achievers. So I want to be really clear about that. But what we do know from the research that Gordon Parker has done and others with the University of New South Wales, and he's a psychiatry professor, is that we know that some of those personality traits can predispose us. That it's really ironic and unfair that the very people who are working so hard to do the right thing and be dutiful and caring are also the people who are a little bit predisposed to experiencing burnout. It's the sting in the tail of that personality type and overplaying those strengths, along, of course, with high stress and work stresses. So what I guess the costs are then is that when we do experience that, and if we're burning out or coming toward burnout, is that we are exhausted and we have that level of fatigue that we can't shake, no matter how many sleeps we have or no matter how many things we try and skip to catch up. You know, we can feel cynical about our work and we can be the instigator or at least a vocal supporter of the conversations in the staff room where we're really digging in a little bit about how we're not enjoying being a school staff member at the moment. We can feel that the work that used to light us up isn't doing that for us anymore. And this is the bit that can really give people the wobbles. We can feel like we're not good at our job anymore or that things we used to be able to do easily, cognitively, we just can't quite grab it, or we're too tired, or we just think we're not quite managing like we used to. And so we really do want to keep an eye on those symptoms because well-being is such a precious resource and it takes much more work to restore it than maintain it. So we want to work on keeping our well-being and keeping those beautiful strengths in check so that we don't tumble into the struggles of burning out and high chronic stress and having to manage the consequences of that if we can help it.
And I love how you've beautifully articulated there, Mel, a roadmap that gives us signs and cues and really signposts to, hang on, I am getting a little bit wobbly here. My body is giving me some really important information and what would be possible if I start to listen to my body and not do the traditional teacher thing where I don't have time for that. When our body says, I need to go to the toilet, I need a drink. Oh no, not now. I'll do that later. And soften a little bit and listen to what our body is telling us because our body is remarkable. I'm blown away so many times to think, gosh, our bodies just keep showing up day in and day out, even when we don't listen, when we tell it to shut up, it just keeps showing up for us. And what would be possible if we listened to our body just a little bit more?
I completely agree, Meg. And I think that many of us have actually tuned out from our body. So not only are we not listening, we actively ignore, we close the door in its face and we go, oh, there's just, I've got to get to the weekend, I've got to get to the school holidays, I've got to get to 3:30. And I just can't agree with you more that actually an embodied response, an approach that considers what our body's telling us, saves us all sorts of strife later when we have to unravel a whole bunch of things that our body had been singing out earlier, but that we just didn't either have the capacity to notice, or we didn't feel that we had the time or the energy to notice, or we thought, I can ignore this because I've always ignored it and I can get a little bit further along. But in the end, the body lets us know when our mind can't keep calling the shots and calling the pace, eventually our body will do it for us and we'll slow down because we have to.
And for me, as an educator and a coach, this is when I get excited sometimes because I feel once we do have that break, for educators, it can be the first time where they give themselves permission to actually stop and look and say, this is actually not working. I am so desperate and willing and open to look at something else because what I'm doing is not working. And this experience of burnout can sometimes, not always, but can sometimes be a beautiful invitation and sometimes brutal invitation to redesign the way that we live and work.
Yeah, I agree with you here as well. I think I've seen it be transformational for people, and I don't say that lightly. And I wonder for us conscientious achievers, how come sometimes it takes us to get down to the wire to realize it, but for many of us, it really does. And so for those of us that aren't down to the wire quite yet, it's a lesson that it would be great to learn before we get there. But that's right. It's an opportunity then to first recognize that the current situation as it is untenable. Most often in my experience too, that can sometimes include a reframing or a refitting of what school means to me and that, oh my goodness, it is actually a job. And how do I refit this as part of my life, not the defining piece of my identity, and then rebuild a life around that realization that's healthy and life-giving, which makes us great colleagues and great staff members working with students anyway. So it has that lovely kicker at the end, but we don't do it for that. We're doing it for ourselves because as worthy, valuable human beings who've chosen to work in education, we deserve to be well.
We really do deserve to be well and we matter. So often we forget that we do matter. Yes, it's wonderful that we support our colleagues, our families, students, but at the end of the day, we matter. The way that we show up every day matters. And so what have been some practical things that the educators that you have worked with have taken on board to allow them to release this pressure and invite a little bit more flexibility into their lives?
Well, I'd say the first thing to do, and this is probably calling on my training most recently as an organizational psychologist, but is to look at those work stressors and look at them without thinking a sense of guilt or a sense of shame or anything needs to accompany this, but really just looking at the stresses that are happening for you at work at the moment and deciding what can stay, but also what can be tweaked, what can be shared, what can be put down, what can be delayed, and not to be afraid to have conversations with leaders about this. And if you're a leader, conversations with your leaders outside of school, whether that's a board in an independent setting or a director in a state school setting, equivalents in Catholic settings. We all need to get better at identifying where those pinch points, those pressure points are for us at work and speaking to them so that, as you mentioned before, Meg, other people can help us or things can be redesigned to be more sustainable, because we can't change things if we don't hear about in really practical and positive and affirming ways about what's not working. So this isn't just an invitation for a complaint fest, but it's a real invitation to say, in my job, here's what's not working, to the voices that count. And there are opportunities to dial back some of those stresses ourselves, as you mentioned before, in terms of the standards of work and the standard of energy that we're putting into our work too. Are there little tweaks that we can do there where we can dial it back a bit, where we can wind it down a little bit, where we can ask for help and do something with a partner or a team? So I'd say that's my first group, is about the work stresses and have a really good look at them and don't believe that they're fixed. In schools, we can kind of think, oh, I can't change that. But nothing can change if we don't start the conversation. And plenty of schools are changing some really cool things. So there are some really good lighthouse examples out there. And I think my second one is looking at your own stress management and what works for you, because it's so personal to each of us. You know, for me, a big one is I'm lucky enough to live near the beach. It's ocean swimming, you know, fantastic. Other people it might be walking or running. And when Professor Gordon Parker did that Australian research recently and asked for the top strategies people used, the top three people identified was talking to others. Exercise was number two, and number three came up as mindfulness meditation. He was quite surprised by that out of all the relaxation strategies that mindfulness meditation came up as number three. In my organization, Compassionate Schools, we're looking at introducing some mindfulness meditation courses next year because they're good skills to practice building our intention and our attention to what's going on. So I'd say your stress management, get that under control, know what works for you. I think the third set, thank you for asking, because it was lovely to have a think about what is working for different people, is, as I mentioned before, if you do have those high standards, or if you are remarkably conscientious, to have a little look at what that's costing you. And to just, you know, you don't need to share it with anyone, but just take some time. What are the benefits, absolutely, of having these traits, but also what are the costs? And am I happy with those costs, or can I wind it back a little bit? And I think finally, a sense around our cost of caring, our empathy. And I'm a big fan of compassion, evidently. That's why I've called the practice Compassionate Schools. But that compassion is different to empathy in that it's inviting ourselves to show concern and have a dose in there of how can I help? So we're not losing ourselves in that empathic response and getting distressed ourselves, but we're really thinking about approaching this more cognitively, more thoughtfully, and keeping our prefrontal cortex running and thinking through solutions. And that helps us stay grounded in what we can offer in the bigger picture for our students and the families and colleagues that we're supporting.
Oh, what a buffet of strategies that we can start to look at and think, oh, I want to pick that one and I want to pick that one. And I love that you highlighted the two top strategies that people go to is that sharing, the social and the movement. And I know for so many of the teachers that I work with, nothing brings them more joy than going for a walk and a talk with another teacher friend. By the end of that walk, they have solved so many of life's issues and school's issues, and we can really build that in because we know it works for us. We enjoy it. We get such a buzz. And then that discipline of blocking it out and prioritizing it. And when we're doing it with a colleague or someone who's working in another school, there's also that added layer of accountability, because if we're going for a walk by ourselves, we're more inclined to like, oh, I don't have time, I'm too busy. But when you've got someone waiting for you at the walking path, you're more likely to go.
And to know that it takes us a little while to build these habits. The latest research says on average 66 days to build a habit. It it's a bit of a long haul, you know, that's a term and a set of holidays. And so if we want to introduce something like some movement into our days, and I take a real biopsychosocial approach with the people that I see and really consider that biological need as a great starting place. But we have to build the habits in, and we want to do it regardless of whether we feel like it. You know, we can't wait for the motivation to kick in. The motivation kind of comes after, and the reward comes after we've started. So we need to get started with a bit of grit and determination and commit to it and commit to our friends, as you say, and get that double dose, if we can, of social support at the same time.
And as we've been having this conversation, I've been thinking there's a group of senior prefects that I work with each year. And it's so interesting to think so many of our senior students have this relentless expectation of themselves, and they start the year so strong doing all the things. They may be a prefect, they may be the head of this and the head of that. And then by the end, they just run out of gas. And so there's an invitation for us to also support the young people in our school systems who fall into that really diligent and capable profile.
And to help them identify it within themselves too. But as you say, it's important that we model it, because we can speak to our seniors about having balance and they see us running around like headless chooks. And it doesn't add up. And as anyone who's a high school teacher knows, they learn from who we are and what we do more than what we say. So in terms of modeling this well-being, starting from the principle down, it's really important that people see living examples of people being well and in schools. Who would have thought 20 years ago we'd be having this conversation? But we are, and we really want to show that schools can be happy, healthy workplaces and communities with expectations to fit, and that we can be part of that change.
And conversations like these are really helping us to step into this new way of being in school life, so we can embrace the joy, we can embrace the laughter, we can embrace presence and connection, because it can be really hard to embrace those elements when we're hyper-focused on the next thing on our list. To wrap up this beautiful conversation, Mel, I'd love to invite you to finish four sentences. Are you up for that?
Absolutely.
I am inspired by
people in schools.
When life feels hard,
I go to the beach.
An underrated skill is
the ability to sleep through anything.
And I am looking forward to
a year spent supporting school staff and my own family too, as they work in schools, to find new ways to recover and restore while we're at work as well as outside of work.
Mel, thank you so much for the work that you are doing in schools and organisations. You bring a wealth of knowledge and expertise to the space. And thank you for being a guest on the School of Wellbeing podcast today.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you for what you do, making, I guess, wellbeing science and research and practice accessible to teachers and school staff as they're fitting it in around their other commitments, in that hope that we can light the path a little bit more brightly to wellbeing and having a satisfying career as a school staff member.
Linda has a wealth of knowledge, and I hope this conversation has inspired you to rethink some of the expectations you are setting for yourself and for the people you work with. To learn more about Melinda and Compassionate Schools, see the show notes for more details. To learn more about the ways that I can help you and your school community thrive, visit my website, openmindeducation.com. There you can book me to speak or download my free 5-step energy guide. You can find all the links from today's episode at openmindeducation.com/episode117. Thank you for listening to this episode of the School of Wellbeing. Until next time, take care and take deliberate action.